First one was with a group of philosophers, and I'm fully recovered from that, so I'm ready to talk to you guys. So Lukasz wanted to know when the floor will drop and I will fall down, at what time the cutoff is. I think it should be 1 hour, maybe a few minutes more, because I'm going to write most of it on the board. Because I don't like to use PowerPoint at all, if possible, but I have unfortunately some real numbers to show, which for me is a new beginning. And for that, I have to bring down the screen. I also don't know exactly the audience I'm talking to. I know some of the people, but not all of the people. So I may tell you things you already know, but that's just how it's going to be. I'd rather be erring on the side of caution than assuming a lot of stuff. So the very first thing to do for people who tune out after, say, 10 minutes, is to tell those people what the problem is, and for the remaining time, try to get into what the answer is. But it's still good to know what the problem is. So the problem is that of what is called a churn band. And I should start by telling you what a churn band is and what problem resides within this churn band. So the best way to do this is to take a real concrete example. And that is to take a certain model Hamiltonian in two dimensions. And you've already gone to momentum space. So everything has been diagonalized in momentum space. But at every momentum p, you got two states. So your Hamiltonian at any momentum p is really a 2x2 matrix. And the one I'm going to consider, which is called the lattice Dirac model, looks like sigma 1 sine px, sigma 2 sine py, plus sigma 3 times some constant m minus cos px minus cos py. That's my Hamiltonian. So it's a 2x2 guy, and you can think of this whole thing as some sigma dot some magnetic field, but the magnetic field depends on where you are in the Brillouin zone. So here's the Brillouin zone, and at every point P, I've got this Hamiltonian sitting. So at every point P, the spinner can either point up or down in the local H direction, and if it points along the field, the way I've defined it, along the field has got higher energy, opposite to the field has lower energy. So take the lower energy state. At every point P, that is a band. So if you move around in momentum space, there'll be one energy, there'll be another energy. This is the energy of the plus band, that's the energy of the minus band, measured at P. We want to focus, let us say, on only the lower band. In the lower band, one can actually ascribe to that lower band, the whole band, when occupied, a certain topological index. And we should understand what that index might be. If I ask you to compute that index, what I'm asking you to do is the following. You have given me some two-component spinner U at every point P in the Brillouin zone. Okay, that's got two components because the Hamiltonian is 2x2 matrix. Given any spinner, we all know that we can get something called the spin vector, which is the expectation value of the Pauli matrix in that spinner state. So spinner has two components, but N has three components. That's how spinners work. Therefore, at every point P, there's an N of P, because everything depends on P. And this N, I've arranged to live on a unit sphere. So the possible values of N are on the unit sphere. So here is my Brillouin zone, and here are the possible values of this object. So every point in the Brillouin zone is associated with the point on the sphere. So when you are done mapping the whole Brillouin zone, it might look like this. That's my whole Brillouin zone. That's called a trivial map, because you can take that map and slowly shrink. You think of it as a little rubber sheet that the Brillouin zone is sitting on top of the sphere. You collapse it to a point. That means every place the spinner has the same value, say the North Pole, then the whole configuration is North Pole. That's the trivial configuration. A non-trivial one is when the sheet manages to go around the sphere once or twice or any number of times. If it goes around once, then the winding number is 1. So that is a topological property of that system. It's topological because you cannot go from 1 to 0 continuously. If you got a 1, it's never going to mix with the 0. When will it do that? It all depends on this parameter m. If m is 50 million, you're going to be sitting at the South Pole. And you will never wander too far from the South Pole. There's no way you will cover the sphere. Likewise, if m is minus 50 million, the same thing. That's the range of m in which it does this non-trivial thing. In that non-trivial thing, when that winding number, which is called the Chern number, it can be plus or minus 1, by some weird convention, I happen to be working with Chern number minus 1. Okay. That's the second way to calculate the Chern number, and that's used all the time. That is to take this U of P and introduce a vector potential in momentum space, which is I times U dagger gradient with respect to P of U. This is called the Berry's vector potential. And it's a vector in because this P, gradient operator in P, can be in X direction or the Y direction. Then you can have a Berry flux, which is the curl of this A. Again, all these operations are done in momentum space. So curl really means d by dpx of Ay, of this Ay, and so on. Then, having got the magnet, this has got no indices because in two dimensions, when you take a curl of a vector field, it's pointing in the third dimension, but you don't know anything about three dimensions. So it's really a scalar. And you can integrate the scalar over the Brillouin zone and divide by 2 pi, and that is called the Chern number, which will be exactly this Chern number. So you've got two ways to compute it. So this is a Chern band. So we've already done half of the half. What's a Chern band? Any band theory I give you, namely a set of points in momentum space with a wave function or a spinner associated with each point, you go and compute this vector potential. You take the curl, you integrate that curl, and divide by 2 pi, you're guaranteed to get an integer. And that integer, if it's not 0, is a non-trivial Chern band. Now, we are interested in this non-trivial Chern number for a couple of reasons. One of the older reasons is that some years ago, Taulis and collaborators showed that any band whose Chern number is not 0 has a Hall conductance, sigma xy, measured in the standard units equal to the Chern number. Chern number is the Hall conductance. Now, I will tell you later on about the standard quantum Hall problem in a magnetic field, where there's a way to compute the Chern number, and you'll find the Chern number is, in fact, equal to sigma xy. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you one very important thing. It's not enough to have a band if nobody is sitting there. The band must be filled. A filled band has this Hall conductance. But what Haldane showed after that is that you don't really need an external magnetic field. You can cook up some model. He had his own example. This is another example. Just take some lattice model and find a band and just go ahead and calculate this. And if you get a non-zero number, that system will show a quantized Hall conductance. That is very solid. Okay? For this, you don't need anything else. And this is all based on non-interacting physics because you find the Chern number the way I've described it to you. But people who reason by analogy said, if a filled Chern band can have a Hall conductance equal to Chern number, maybe a 1/3 filled Chern band can have a Hall conductance equal to 1/3 or 1/5 or one of these magic fractions. So there are two sets of magic fractions one is interested in. One are the Laughlin fractions, where the Hall conductance is 1 over 2s plus 1 times e squared over h. And then there are the Jane fractions, which is p over 2p s plus 1. But I'm going to put s equal to 1 in this talk. They're not quite the same. They're a different set of fractions. OK, so we know in those days, if you take a Landau level and do something to it, you can get a Hall conductance. But what is interesting nowadays is that without a magnetic field, you can get a Hall conductance. All right. When you fill it partially and you don't do anything else, the answer is not going to be a quantum Halde effect. Because if you take a band, you know, in, as a function of momentum, it wiggles like that, and you fill it to 1/5, and all the guys are going to be sitting there, then that's not a quantum Halde system. That's a Fermi liquid, because it's got gapless excitations there and there. So we know that without interactions, you cannot expect anything except Fermi liquid. But you can imagine that if you got interactions, which are very, very large, so that this band structure is really negligible compared to that, then perhaps with very large electron-electron interactions, you may be able to get a fractional quantum Hall effect. That is the hope. Turns out, numerical work shows that this is actually correct. Now, I'm not going to be giving too many references because I'm talking, and I don't know them off my head. So somewhere in my computer are references. If you need it, I will give it to you later. But we know from numerical work that there is this really does happen. But it's on small systems, like some 5 or 6 electrons. At the analytical front, there is not too much you can do. Because unlike in the Laughlin case, where if you know enough about it, the lowest Landau level wave functions are analytic functions, and the answer should be anti-symmetric. If you put them together, you will find the Laughlin fractions of this form, with Zi minus Zj cubed and 5th power and 7th power. That's why the numbers 5 and 7 and 3 are all natural for Laughlin, because they are a combination of anti-symmetry and analyticity. There's no reason why this insulator, which doesn't have any nice wave functions, no one has really written down any of these wave functions, why should it like one fraction over another? It's not clear. And also, once you got the ground state wave function, you may want to compute various quantities, like a gap or maybe response functions. They are things that are in a very primitive stage. But I'm going to tell you a way in which, if you could do something in the quantum Hall effect, you can also do it here. That is the thrust of my talk. If people say, what did this guy talk about? He said that if you can do the quantum Hall, you can do this, because I'm going to transform this problem of the Chern band into a problem that's really some more complicated version, but doable version of the quantum Hall effect. So what's the problem we have to solve? The problem we have to solve, if you have a computer, is to take first a band with some band energy. This is the kinetic energy of the electrons. Then you have to put some interactions. The interactions are sum over Q of the density, but that's the density projected to this band. In other words, the density is some d dagger d, where d daggers and d can be in the upper band and the lower band. But when you do the Chern band calculation, this d and d dagger refer to the creation and destruction operators of the one band that's occupied and the one band I'm interested in, the one band I'm calling the Chern band. So rho is a density written out of those guys. If you go and calculate it, the rho Chern band at Q will look like d dagger of p plus q d of p times some function of q and p, which I don't want to write down. But to know that function, you must solve for the wave functions u. It's some combination of u dagger of p plus q and up. This p plus q in bracket means if p is in the Brillouin zone and q takes you outside the Brillouin zone, you should take away some element of the reciprocal lattice to bring it back to the Brillouin zone. In other words, the only allowed moment to live in the Brillouin zone, if you start there, you add a momentum q like that, well, that's not allowed. That's not a possible momentum. You subtract from it a multiple of g to bring it here. That's what these brackets mean. Anyway, here's a mathematical problem. Here's the density. You're supposed to put the density there and square it and solve that problem. That's what you want to do. So you ask yourself, what can I do? How can I exploit my knowledge of the quantum Hall problem to do this? So let me remind you about the quantum Hall problem. So here is where the review may not be necessary, but I'm going to do it anyway. So the quantum Hall, because some of the things I used there may not be common knowledge. So the Hamiltonian in the quantum Hall is pi squared over 2m, where pi is p minus Ea. This can also be written as eta squared over 2ml to the fourth, where eta is some magnetic length times z hat cross pi. Z hat is a unit vector in perpendicular to the plane, and L squared is 1 over EB. And eta has got an x component and a y component that do not commute, but instead they're equal to this. Once you see that, you can see it's a harmonic oscillator because this is like a P and that's like a Q, and you're squaring the P's and the Q's, and you get these famous cyclotron levels. The spacing between them is omega is EB over N. But this is a problem. This is called the cyclotron coordinate. But see, this problem looks like a one-dimensional problem, and we know we are doing a two-dimensional problem. And the reason is that the one-dimensional levels are very, very degenerate. Everything I show as a level here is really zillions of levels. And you want to ask, how big is that? How many levels do you have? The answer is the number of levels you have depends on how big your system is. The reason, one way to understand that, is to notice that in two dimensions, you've got two coordinates and two momenta. You've got really two canonical pairs, x and px and y and py. This is just one canonical pair. Turns out there's one more pair. The one more pair is called the guiding center coordinate, and its commutation rules look like minus IL squared, and the guiding center coordinate is your usual position coordinate minus the cyclotron coordinate. Another way to write it is that the usual coordinate is a guiding center coordinate plus a cyclotron coordinate. Even though I call them coordinate, only the components of R deserve to be called coordinates because they commute. The components of eta x and eta y do not really commute. It's like a semi-classical world where you talk about coordinates and momentum at the same time. So this R has got nowhere to go. It has no role to play in the problem. It's not in the Hamiltonian. It commutes to the Hamiltonian. So the question is, what should this R do? R is also like a coordinate in momentum. And if you compare it to xp equals ih bar, well, L squared looks like h bar. And what's the range of this value R? If your system lives on some sample, some L by L sample, the cyclotron coordinate is some quantum mechanical size. And this guiding center coordinate is as big as you like. That you add the cyclotron coordinate, that's the position of the electron. So this coordinate can roam all over the sample. But it is not, for the guy called R, this is really phase space, because Rx and Ry don't commute. You have a quantum problem in a phase space of area A. The number of states you have is obtained by dividing by h, or 2 pi h bar, and the fellow who's playing the role of h bar here is L squared. So that's the number of states you have. And if you use the definition of L squared, you will find it's equal to A E B divided by 2 pi. A times B is the flux, and 2 pi over E is the flux quantum. And so here is the result you have to know. The number of states I can fit into a Landau level is a sample area divided by, it's a flux measured in units of the flux quantum. No one is saying the flux is really quantized in the sample. The flux is continuous. But if you measure it in the units of the flux quantum, if you get 30 million, you can put 30 million electrons per Landau level. That's that situation. Now, if you have 30 million electrons per Landau level, and you also have 30 million electrons, then you fill one Landau level. And if you fill one Landau level, it's very easy to solve that problem because there's only one way to put that many fermions in an equal number of levels. That's why the integer quantum Hall effect is easy to understand without interactions. But if you've got fractional filling, so the lowest Landau level, say, has got three states, and you've got only one electron, there are three ways to put it. And if you've got two electrons, there are more ways to put it. There are too many ways to put the electrons in those levels. So at the non-interacting level, that's a huge space of degenerate ground states, and you don't know what to do. And you hope the interactions will somehow tell you what to do, or Laughlin will tell you what to do, which is what happened here. So he just wrote down an answer, which we believe now is an excellent guess for what happens in the ground state. Now, I'm going to use another approach, which is used by Jane, because for me, that's what works. But before proceeding, I want to give you one little exercise here, which is, how do you find the churn number of a Landau level? Remember, to find the churn number, I told you to take those wave functions and take U dagger, gradient U. What are those states? Well, if you got electrons in the continuum, say the magnetic field coming out of the board, mentally imagine a lattice. It's not a real lattice. You mentally imagine dividing it into little squares so that there's one quantum of flux per square. Why do you do that? You do that because if you want to get momentum eigenstates, our temptation would be to take translation in the x direction and y direction and find the simultaneous eigenstates. But in a magnetic field, one can show that Tx and Ty do not commute. But in fact, the commutator is related to the flux enclosed by the square in the xy plane. But if the square encloses one flux quantum, they do commute. Therefore, if you take this to be your cell, then if you promise to translate only by multiples of this number, then eigenstates of that operator can define a momentum. That's the momentum you use. And if you take those momentum eigenstates, which I won't bother to write down, and you calculate this A, which is I times U star grad PU, you will find the answer is really PY over 2 pi. And if you take the curl of this, which is, you'll find AX is equal to PY and AY is equal to 0. The curl of this will be 1 over 2 pi, and if you integrate it over the Brillouin zone and divide by 2 pi and so on, you'll get your churn number of 1. But I want you to know that you can describe the Landau level problem using momenta. That's very, very important. We always think of momentum as not being in a Brillouin zone in the continuum. But you can. If you take one Landau level, then the translation operators of the problem are really discrete translations only, not continuum translations. And then these are the labels for those translating, commuting translation operators. So what is one supposed to do for the fractional quantum Hall effect? Fractional quantum Hall effect, the Hamiltonian, this is again an example of a churn band, except it's a churn band we know how to beat. So it's got a kinetic energy of 0, because the lowest Landau level, you can take that energy to 0. So the entire Hamiltonian is just this, rho of q, whatever interaction you like, and rho of minus q. This rho bar is the density projected to the lowest Landau level. Now, that turns out to be a very nice guy. That's what I want to tell you about. The density operator, you remember, is e to the I q dot r j summed over j. You go back somewhere to what I wrote on the blackboard, and you write that as e to the I q dot r j plus eta j summed over all the particles. That is the rho of q in the full Hilbert space. But if you want to be in the lowest Landau level, you project it on the left and right with the lowest state of the cyclotron coordinate. In other words, you take the average of this in the lowest oscillator state, and that gives you this famous factor, L squared over 4 times e to the I q dot r. This is called the magnetic translation operator. And this is the fellow I'm going to look at. This you can absorb here. So essentially, the lowest Landau level problem has a charge density, which is the magnetic translation operator. What do we know about this operator? This was first studied by many, many people, but in the quantum Hall case by Gervin, McDonald and Platzman, which is why it's going to be called the GMP algebra, rho of q1 commutated to rho of q2 is what? Try to do this in your head. Since every coordinate, j, commutes with every other coordinate, it's enough to do it for just one guy. You just have to combine an rx and an ry, or a q times r and a q prime times r. Combine the exponentials in your head, there's only one non-commutating part because rx and ry don't commute. And if you take that into account, you will find it is really so this is the famous GMP algebra. It's got also got many other interpretations, but in the quantum hall, it's called this. And by using this algebraic property, you can do a variety of things involving, for example, the collective modes of this problem. Okay, now, why is this problem so hard? What makes the problem difficult? After all, it's got only the potential energy. Looks like there's no problem. It's a kinetic that doesn't commute with the potential, except even though it's called a potential energy, once you project it, it looks like e to the I q dot ri minus rj times some v summed over q. The rx and ry don't commute with each other. It's like an exponential of coordinates and momenta there, so it's not a simple problem. Now, when you don't have a simple problem, people try to do a Hartree-Fock calculation. In Hartree-Fock, you assume some product state and hope that it works. Unfortunately, there is no non-attracting product state you can think of. Because you got one-third the number of particles or one-fifth the number of states, as there are, you got one-fifth the number of particles is one-third or one-fifth or some fraction of the number of states. So you don't know where to put them. That's why you cannot write a Hartree-Fock state to do the calculation. There was no simple way to do that. So the only way this subject flourished is when people like Laughlin came along and managed to write down, by great intuition, some wave functions that worked. Then Jane came along and wrote more wave functions for other fractions. So I'll tell you one more way to attack this problem. So where are we now? We are doing the quantum Hall problem. We have realized that you have to put in the interactions, because without interactions at fractional filling, you don't know which one-third of the states you should even fill. And the problem mathematically is to take a density which doesn't commute with itself at another q and take those guys and try to solve the problem. And the difficulty, I said, is that there is no mean field state you can start with because there are too many states for a given number of particles. So here's where Jane had an idea. Jane's idea, which everybody must have heard, but I just have to mention it because that's not what I do, but it's important. So Jane's theory is called composite fermion theory, which I will just caricature here, is that if this is an electron and it's seeing three flux quanta, there is a trick in two dimensions in which you may trade an electron for another fermion to which you attach two flux quanta pointing in the opposite direction. And you do that to each and every electron, then these flux quanta are seen by all the other guys. And for every three that came from outside, there are two from inside which are opposing it. So that in the end, some new animal called the composite fermion sees one quantum. It knows what to do. Because you got one state per composite fermion, then you fill the lowest Landau level of composite fermions. So is there anybody here who's not heard about Jane's composite fermion? I'm assuming you know that because I don't want to elaborate on that. So the composite fermion is a new animal which has a charge E star. I'll do it all for the one-third example. E star is E divided by 2P plus 1. It's got a magnetic length, L star square, which is 2P plus 1 times L square. So it's an animal which has a weaker charge, therefore sees a weaker field. The field is weakened just enough so that the number of states in its Landau level equal the number of composite fermions. That's the trick. That's what Jane did. And how do you do the flux attachment? There are many ways. You can do the wave functions with a singular gauge transformation. You can go to a path integral formulation and do something called Chern-Simons theory. But now I'm going to tell you the trick that is invented by my collaborator, Ganpati Murthy, and me. We did this a few years back. So everything I describe here is done with him. So he is my worst graduate student. He He's also my best graduate student. You know what that implies? He's my only graduate student. So somehow, we started this collaboration for 25 years. We've been, I mean, he graduated. Don't worry, he's already graduated. He's a professor somewhere, but we've been working on it for a long time. So he and I are known as the Majorana men. We're called Majorana men because, number one, we are real, real men. Number two, it takes two of us to do the work of one normal man. And number three, the information is stored non-locally. So the answer to many of your questions, I don't have. So I will have to refer you to him. He's somewhere in fact, he's in Russia right now, which is where I want him during this talk. Okay, so this is all done with Ganapati, in case I didn't mention it earlier. What was our approach to this problem? It's called the Hamiltonian approach, and it's very simple. The density, let me write in first quantization, the GMP density for a single particle is just e to the I q dot r. I'm going to call it r sub electron because some other animal is going to come in soon. And the fact that rex and rey don't commute but have a commutation relation like this is what makes the problem difficult. It also defines the problem completely at the first quantized level. It's a well-defined operator. We are going to introduce now, imagine in your mind, another particle. It sees its own magnetic field, a weaker magnetic field. Therefore, that particle will have its own guiding center coordinate. Now, anything without a subscript is now the composite fermion. The electron subscript is what it had without a subscript before, but that's what the old one is. This eta sees, obeys this commutation rule. And it's got a guiding center coordinate, which obeys that commutation rule. And r and eta commute, just like in the electronic case. Are you with me now? The L that comes on the right-hand side depends on the magnetic field seen by the object. I want one which sees an L star that Jane would like to have. So here is that object. Then I claim, if you do the follow, this is the most important step. You can write the electronic guiding center coordinate as this combination, where C squared is 2p over 2p plus 1. I guarantee you that if you take the commutator of x and y of this guy and use the commutator of rx and ry and eta x and eta y and this particular value of C and use the relation of L star to L, you will find that this r does what it's supposed to do, namely rex, rey is equal to I L squared. Therefore, we may write down the density, the rho GMP, as sum over composite fermions of e to the I q dot rj plus eta jc summed over j. So this is also an operator in the world of the composite fermion. It's got both the guiding center and the cyclotron present. This is the thing to understand. For the electron, it's got only the guiding center coordinate. But for the composite fermion, it involves both the guiding center and the composite fermion coordinate. This object has exactly the same commutation rules, but it's realized in a bigger Hilbert space. Okay? So if you go and make the substitution, the interaction Hamiltonian, replace everywhere this object, and you have not changed the problem in terms of its commutation rules. So you can say, if you haven't changed anything, why are you doing this, right? What's the point of doing this? The point of doing this is that this new object sees a weaker magnetic field so that it can fill exactly P lambda levels, just like in Jane's approach. So we've introduced an object whose number and flux are such that it will fill an integer number of lambda levels. Therefore, the same Hamiltonian, when viewed as a Hamiltonian for composite fermions, will admit a Hartree-Fock state in which some integer number of composite fermion Landau levels will be filled. So we take that state. In that state, we put this operator times rho of minus q times v. We find the expectation value. That's the energy in the ground state. Then once you fill some number of Landau levels for the composite fermion, you can take one from the highest Landau level that's filled and pop it up to the one above that, and you get a particle hole excitation, and that's the gap. Not only that, we can now compute, unlike in the wave function-based approach, all kinds of correlation functions involving the density. Anything involving density, I can, because I have it as an operator in a second quantized notation, I can write this down. I can calculate density-density correlation function as a function of frequency, as a function of wavelength, even at finite temperature, because you can do Hartree-Fock at finite temperature. We have done this for many, many, many things in the old standard quantum Hall problem. Okay, so this is the main point. So our approach to composite fermions is not to do the flux attachment in the standard way, but to create another problem, which is algebraically the same as ours, but realized in the space of this fermion, which now admits a mean field state, Hartree-Fock state. That is what you should know. And the fact that that's useful and it can do many things, I don't have time to go into, but that's what we did for a few years. For example, you can take a nu equal to half, and you can calculate the polarization of nu equal to half as a function of the magnetic field, something I don't know how to do in any other wave function-based approach. Or I can, my colleague Sean Barrett computed NMR relaxation rates at 1/2 as a function of temperature. We can calculate that too. Only thing you need is the interaction between electrons. That's how it should be. The lowest Landau level problem should be solved by just using the electron-electron interaction. You shouldn't need anything else. All right, so what have I done so far? I've done so far is to show you that the usual quantum Hall effect can be solved by using a Hartree-Fock state by making this substitution. This is the key to what I'm saying. Now, how do we propose to solve the real problem, the churn band problem? So I'm going to tell you the answer now. The rest of it is really telling you how it's implemented. So pretty much I'm done when I give you that explanation. Now, let's go back to the density operator. This is what it looks like in first quantization. In second quantization, if you write it, it will look like this. D dagger, let me write it here. Rho GMP, this is again for the quantum Hall problem of Q. Looks like a D dagger P plus Q. That means modulo G, DFP times e to the sum function phi of Q and P. This is just the expectation value of e to the iq dot r between a p on the right and a p plus q on the left. You calculate some number. And you're sure that if you took the commutation of rho of q with rho of q prime, you will get what you got there. What I'm telling you is the following. Give me a churn band. Take the d's and d daggers off the churn band and construct exactly this object. And it'll obey exactly the GMP algebra. Because the fact that it obeys an algebra does not depend on what the D and D dagger stand for. They don't have to be from a lowest Landau level. They can be any set of canonical operators. The whole magic is in these coefficients. Therefore, in any band, you can construct operators that obey the GMP algebra. That's the first point to note. Second is, take the churn band density, which I've told you looks like some d dagger p plus q dp times some function of q and p. I claim that you can write this as a sum of rho gmp of q plus g with some coefficients that depend on g, but g is all the possible reciprocal lattice vectors. This is the most important construction that we make. Step one, with every problem, there are operators that obey rho GMP. Step two, every density may not be a rho GMP by itself, except in the quantum Hall case, but it's always a linear combination of rho GMPs whose momenta are q plus g with some coefficients. So this q lives in the Brillouin zone. This object does not have to have its momentum limited to the Brillouin zone. Can be whatever you like. Now, if you put it on a finite system, you find remarkably the number of q values, which is the number of points in the Brillouin zone, is also the number of distinct g values. that's a bit of a surprise that there's an upper limit to the value of g that you have because you're in the continuum. If you take a bigger g, what happens is if you put q plus g there, if g is bigger than some amount, the space factor starts repeating itself. So the number of independent GMP operators you get is really equal to the number of possible q's and the number of possible g's. But then if you took a generic two single particle operator in a blue one zone, that's the same number of operators. In other words, the number of GMP operators of the form rho of q plus g is equal in number to the complete set of two one body operators. So they are a different basis. This is the basis everyone likes to use. We're saying you can also use this basis and you can expand it. And the expansion coefficients, if you think a little more, turn out to be simply Fourier expansions of this function of p at a given q using this, if g is really 2 pi nx times I plus 2 pi ny times j, if you expand this function at q plus g, you will find factors like e to the 2 pi nx py minus ny px. And you can see that the sum over n is simply a Fourier expansion. So what happens is, in the quantum Hall problem, this is actually a pretty nice function. In a churned band, it's a complicated function. But the complicated function has a Fourier expansion. It's like saying, if I know how to solve the driven harmonic oscillator for a cosine, I know how to solve it for any periodic function, because a periodic function can be written as a sum over cosine. It's no more difficult. So the answer to a sawtooth wave function and the answer to cosine of the same wavelength, they are not the same. The cosine is privileged, but it's solved in principle when you solve the other one. That's our claim. That's my claim. That's the relation of the churned band to the Landau level problem. The density in the churned band is a known linear combination, known in the sense of Fourier expansion of rho GMPs. But every rho GMP is defined by its algebra, and that I can satisfy using the trick I had here. I make the substitution in terms of composite fermions. So if you want a one-third filled churned band, I'll make a substitution where L star squared is three times as big, then I will get a state of the composite fermion, which is one-third filled, filled Landau level. And then you do Hartree-Fock, and it's a mean field theory. You can compute a variety of things. So that's what, in the remaining time, I'm going to show you some pictures to see how that's done. There's one other thing you do, which is very interesting to me. In the continuum, the Hall conductance is the same as the filling factor in dimensionless units. In a lattice problem, that doesn't have to be true. Hall conductance and the filling factor are not the same. In fact, we have a concrete example where the filling fraction of the churned band is 1/5 and the Hall conductance is 2/5. Now, if you ever try to ask, how can ever a 1/5 lead to a 2/5? After all, Jane had exhausted all the possible fractions. If you do the naive calculation in the continuum, 1/5 will require you to fill a third of a Landau level for a composite fermion. But for composite fermion, you're supposed to fill an integer number of Landau levels because that's where the gap is. But if the composite fermion also experiences the magnetic field of the periodic potential of the lattice, then the composite fermion Landau level splits into subbands. And you really want to get in between two subbands of the composite fermion Landau level. And when you do that, when a single Landau level splits into three of them, you want to put your Fermi level there. That gives rise to fractions. And the new Hall conductance depends on the churn number of this guy. Even though the three of them have churn number one in totality, this can be 5 million. It just happens to be two in our example. So such systems are also possible. That's something people are not looking at very carefully, but we know it's there, and we can find that state in Hartree-Fock. So I'm going to show you the pictures, but the pictures I show you are the following. I said, give me any band on any lattice problem, like the lattice Dirac model, and I will tell you how to do the Hall calculation, which is to take the density in the churned band and expand it in terms of rho GMPs and do Hartree-Fock. But we did another class of problems, which are morally the same, but somewhat easier to handle. What do you want in the end? You want a band in which the Betty flux, B of P, is not constant. whereas in the quantum Hall case, BFP is a constant. In general, BFP varies up and down. That's what frustrated people who were trying to solve it using quantum Hall kind of techniques. So I will produce for you a band in which BFP is not constant. In fact, it has a profile not very different from the lattice Dirac model. But there, we know how to solve the whole thing. We can do the whole expansion a lot easily. So maybe this is the time I'm going to switch to my projector. And wait. RGB, right? Oh, somebody's doing it for me. You did that? You have a question? Yes. Yes.
And how you choose this L star?
You choose L star so that if you got 1/3 filling.
But you have freedom to choose.
You do. That is correct. That's correct.
So given a choice, L star is like a doing different mean field calculation.
Yes. You pick an L star so that you can have a good mean field solution. That's the guiding principle.
So for the given Hamiltonian, you could choose different L star to see which L star gave you better.
That is correct. That's right. So we don't, the L star, the particular fraction does not jump out at us. So you must try for different fractions.
Okay.
And then do the suitable attachment so that you can get a mean field state. That's correct.
So the algebra you have later will depend on L star?
Yes. Yes. Algebra will depend on L star. In the sense that, when I make the composite fermion substitution, those space factors, e to the I phi, they will all contain L star. You'll see number 3 in our paper for that particular problem. That's right.
Okay.
Now I got, it's on? Okay. Okay, I'm going to skip this because we have already done this. This is the thing I want to mention now. Suppose you want a variable BFP. You take one Landau level and another Landau level on top of it. Each one has a constant variflux density. They're just sitting on top of each other. Imagine that the higher Landau levels have been banished by choice of dispersion relation. You got only these two. Put a periodic potential, which is e to the iq dot r, where q is equal to some periodic lattice wavelength, will mix the two Landau levels because it contains a cyclotron coordinate. So these two Landau levels will now get mixed. Then you will have two bands. It's a 2x2 matrix problem in this Landau level world. And the lower of the two bands, which I call the modified lowest Landau level, is going to be my Chern band. So in that Chern band, you can calculate the density operator. And the Hamiltonian you get looks exactly like the lattice Dirac model in this two-band problem. That's in the bottom line. I don't know how well you can read it. But you got to, there are some tricky points I don't want to get into. This is in the trivial region of the lattice Dirac model. But the Chern number is still -1 because the wave functions in this problem are non-trivial. Normally, when you take the gradient, you take the gradient acting on u of k, but the basic spinners are 1, 0, and 0, 1. But here, the basic spinners are the block wave function for the band that have p dependence. That's where the Chern number comes from, for those who wonder how that happened. Now here's a comparison of the Berry flux density. The upper one is our FACO Chern band. The lower one is the lattice Dirac model. So you can see that it's got fairly typical variations. So I'm saying, why should I solve the lower problem, which is so much harder for me? I'm going to solve the upper one. After all, they're both models. Neither one of them is really particularly physical. So we've got the band, we have the electron density, and we have to write it in terms of rho GMP. And then this is the last step. I should ask you to think about, how do I know, what made us think about this expansion? Remember I told you the expansion, every rho is a combination of rho GMPs. How does that happen? Well, if you take this two Landau level problem, before you put the periodic potential, This is my churn band, and the row there is in fact rho GMP. Once I put the periodic potential, then the row gets rotated by unitary transformation to go to the exact eigenbasis. And the elements of the unitary matrix only contain e to the iq, e to the ig dot r. They are the entries of the matrix. So when you multiply an e to the ig dot r by an e to the iq dot r any number of times, you can only get another GMP operator. That's how we knew in that concrete problem that the worst thing that can happen is rho GMP. Then later on, it occurred to us that you don't have to go at it this way, just a completeness relationship. But in this problem, that's how it comes out. OK, so this is at least something I want to talk about. You take a one-third filled churn band manufactured in this way. You take the lower of the two Landau levels after mixing, and you put some interaction between them. This, I think, is a Coulomb interaction. Fill it at one-third, and then you find that's the lower band where you have to, that's the lowest composite fermion band. That's the next one and the next one. So this is very narrow. You cannot see that. So here is where your Fermi energy is. That's the gap is the one from here to here. So you can get in Hartree-Fock a mean field state of the composite fermion.
What is the
VEE, the strength of interaction? Yeah, the interaction is VEE over 2 pi VEE over Q. The Coulomb interaction has a charge VEE. Yes, this is the lowest energy of that band. That's the highest energy of that band. In other words, there's going to be three Landau levels of the composite fermion when you do this, and they all get mixed when split within fractions. This is the lowest of the three bands, and this is the composite fermion problem, where you got enough fermions to fill the lower band. So you will fill up, you can put the fermion level anywhere here. The one thing we did not like earlier on was, we know that if the band has a width, namely the band is oscillating, and you put an interaction which is extremely weak, you should get a Fermi liquid. You should not get a quantum Hall state. The quantum Hall state should emerge only for strong values of VEE, whereas here it seems to be present for very small values. So what happens is, here we compare the energy of the ground state for the composite fractional quantum Hall state versus the Fermi liquid. And you find for small values of repulsion, the Fermi liquid is lower in energy, and beyond some strength, the Fermi liquid loses to the quantum Hall state. So the theory does not internally tell you you're doing something wrong. In other words, you keep getting a quantum Hall state, even though there's a competing state of lower energy. But that's the way Hartree-Fock works. Unless there's an instability in that state, you don't know that it's going to win. The only way we could tell was to compare it to the Fermi liquid. Even here, we think our state wins, but you may be able to come up with a different state, maybe a charge density wave, which is lower than this, in which case our Hartree-Fock state is irrelevant. So we won't know within our Hartree-Fock state whether it's the winner or not. Hartree-Fock is not the best one for energetics. So we have to cooperate with people who do other things, like exact calculations. Exact calculation people tell me that's a state at one-third. If I know that it's there, then I believe this, at least in this region, then I can then do lots of computations that they cannot do, because this is an operator-based theory. You can compute various things in this state. So in general, when we do Hartree-Fock, it's our obligation to compare it to every other state we can think of. And if it beats every other state we can think of, we can claim that the fractional quantum state is the ground state. But if you can surprise me with a new one, then I have to drop that. Okay, now this is the fraction that I mentioned to you earlier, with nu not equal to sigma. So here there are three bands. This is a composite fermion Landau level that is split into three subbands. And the Fermi level is now over here. This lower band has churn number 2, which is why you get the 2/5. Here also, we did a comparison to that other. I'm just giving you one more example. Of how you know, suppose you don't know how to compare it to another theory, like a Fermi liquid. Here's an internal test. I'm just going to show you in this one example. This is the occupation number of the three Landau levels. the Landau level theory, the composite fermion theory is really a good theory only for the ground state because it's a unique ground state. It is not a good theory for all excitations because the Hilbert space is just too big. The composite fermion Hilbert space has got no end at the top, whereas the Landau levels are a countable number per area. So the way that theory tells you is that if your interaction is pretty strong, is pretty weak, then a lot of particles tend to gravitate to the higher Landau levels. Whereas if your interaction is very strong, I don't know if I have that picture here or not, then you will find, so there are internal tests. Namely, if the fermions stay in the lowest composite fermion Landau level and don't make use of the higher Landau levels you provide, then we trust it. If they start climbing up to the higher Landau levels, wanting to go even higher, then we know that it's no good as a low energy theory. But that's not a sharp line. At some point, you realize that you cannot believe that. This is the last picture I want to show you, which is take the lattice Dirac model, which I said I can solve now. Take the density operator of the lattice Dirac and do the Fourier expansion. Just compare the elements of the matrix, the coefficients of the D dagger D. This is the actual exact answer for lattice Dirac, that is the fit with some number of harmonics. I claim you can mimic the density operator using some of GMP densities. But we have not done the Hartree-Fock for this particular linear combination. I think that's just more of the same. We'll eventually get around to it. But for us, the main point was, in any problem with the variable B, if we can do the Hartree-Fock, we know we can do it here also. Last thing that came up is, take a band whose Chern number is zero. So it's got some Chern number plus here and minus there, integral is zero. I've shown you that in every band, I can always create an operator that looks like rho GMP. I can expand in every problem the density in terms of rho GMPs, and maybe I'll get a Hartree-Fock state. Then what have I got? I mean, is this real, is this false? In the examples we tried, we found that state, even though it comes as self-consistent Hartree-Fock state, is higher in energy than Fermi liquid for any possible interaction. But I could imagine one day giving a better lattice model in which the Chern number is zero, but that's a genuine Hartree-Fock state, a genuine fractional quantum Hall state. If you fill the Chern number zero band, you got to get zero Hall conductance. If you partially fill a Chern number zero band, it's not clear. It has to spontaneously break time reversal. For example, maybe the wave function will sit in the region where Chern number is one sign compared to another sign. I don't know, but I don't know if anybody can rule that out for me. I'm eager to hear it. But this possibility occurred to us. But I know this much. If you ever find that state, we know how to describe it, because you will never know how to describe it in terms of composite fermions, and we will. But like everything else we do, we can never guarantee that the states that come in our theory are guaranteed to exist. We really need external validation of that. Okay, so the summary is, in the old days when we did the lowest Landau level, our trick was to take the electron coordinate and write it in terms of composite fermion coordinates and satisfy the algebra. Then the composite fermions fill an integer number of Landau levels. The approach now is that the Chern band density is some expression, and you can always write the Chern density as a linear combination of rho GMPs, and for every one of them, you can make the substitution. That's the summary. And that's the end of the talk. Thank you.
Questions? Within this framework, I wonder, you probably can choose a different C and et cetera. So among the states, you can cook up, you can say which one have a lowest energy.
Yes.
Whether that would give you some kind of indication what it should be a ground state.
Oh, you mean if I have a certain filling fraction?
Yeah.
For that filling fraction, the natural thing is to take a composite fermion, which will fill an integer number of.
Yeah, maybe there are several choices of a C which satisfy. So that the band, you have your composite fermion fill several bands. And then you can compare those Cs to see which one have lower energy.
Yes. So I'm just telling you that if there is a fractional churn insulator of these fractions, then no, I can say more than that. Without this construction, I do not know why the churn band will prefer any fraction, because I don't have the analyticity arguments or the usual arguments. By this mapping, the composite fermions certainly select out certain fractions when they either fill an integer number of their Landau levels or integer number of their subbands. They are the fractions I say now, at least I understand why the insulator likes those fractions. Now, whether it really will do that or not depends on what the competition is. It may just be a Fermi liquid most of the time. I just don't know.
More questions? Can you play the same game when you have time reversal not broken and look at?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. So they will come in pairs, right? The states will come in pairs. Because each will have its own churn number. I don't know, maybe you'll have to apply a field and split them, and then you can do this. But if they're competing with each other, I've not thought about what to do.
But that you have a separate constellation. I mean, if you only have one U1 constellation, it's not like a two component of its opposite.
Right, so they will have opposite churn numbers.
In a time reversal invariant problem,
the partners will have opposite churn numbers, right?
So you probably cannot view as a two-field Landau level with opposite churn numbers.
No, you cannot.
No.
I'm saying it will be two bands which are degenerate by time reversal, right? The original problem.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not doing any Landau. The bands are given to us two at a time. You agree? The time reversal invariant problem. Or is it one band which obeys some symmetries between k and minus k? Is that what you mean or what? See, if you don't want to break time reversal symmetry, I think you want to glue together. One is the simplest gluing of up and down spins experiencing opposite magnetic fields. But I thought there are more sophisticated ways of Kane and Mealy. But now I do not know. If you give me a single band in any problem with a churn number which is not zero, and you want it to fractionalize, you can do it this way. By the way, I should mention other ways to get fractions, which is the parton model. The parton model, I had them all in another slide. You can write the electron as power of three parton operators. And three is natural because you want it to be fermion. And that will give you very natural fractions, namely the Laughlin fraction. And you can also write down the wave function again by writing a cube of some single band wave function. So there are other constructions which also suggest certain fractions. The composite fermion suggests its own fractions. Yep. Yes. Go ahead.
Well, just in case someone else. So have you compared the energies with, as you said, more sophisticated numerical methods?
No. We've not. Look, if you do a Hartree-Fock calculation on a PC using Mathematica, you don't want to compare it to anybody, except your own calculation for the Fermi liquid. I don't know, I'm curious. I'll tell you why I didn't compare so far. I had never done the lattice Dirac model. We instead took these two Landau levels that got mixed into a churn band and with a Coulomb interaction. That's not what anybody simulates on a computer or solves exactly. They solved the lattice Dirac model on a computer with short-range interactions. For that, we've just got this expansion of rho churn band as a huge sum of rho GMPs. We've got to put that and do the Hartree-Fock. Then you're right. No, we should look at the energies. I'm just saying that when I used to compare it to Jane in the old days, the old FQHE days, Jane gets answers to four or five decimal places, and we don't. We're a 10% field. That's why I wouldn't compare it. I would just say that all the qualitative features you can calculate this way. And it gets much better at finite temperature and even with disorder. No one else can do anything at finite temperature, but we can't. You know how to do Hartree-Fock at finite temperature. So and it's also always in the thermodynamic limit. That's the other advantage. It's not a finite size problem. And the weakness is it's a Hartree-Fock calculation. Hartree-Fock is an uncontrolled approximation. You just don't know how to correct it. You also don't know if the choice of state you make corresponds to what the system will actually take.
One more question. Let's thank Professor Shankar again.